Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out this afternoon on a beautiful day when baseball and the weather are a big thing here in Scottsdale. Thank you, virtual audience, for joining us. I'm always delighted to have Michael Carita. We've been together for his entire career, I think.
20 years now, yes.
I know. It's just great. But Michael is here today under a different name, as you can see right over here, called Lost Man's Lane. So maybe you'd like to explain why it's Scott Carson this time.
Yeah, you mentioned baseball. So the name is taken from the natural. Scotty Carson was the scout who was never on screen, and you didn't really know if he was working for the good guys or the bad guys. So that was where I came up with the pseudonym. But I write under the Carson name when the books are more of the supernatural kind of Stephen King territory. You know, if there's going to be a ghost or anything of that nature, it's Scott Carson these days.
Got it.
And then I'd let Carita handle the, you know, straightforward crime novel.
Right. And they're wonderful either way. I think because Michael is one of the best prose stylists that I'm not really looking in the right direction. Let me just sort of back this up a little bit. One of the reasons that I love Michael's work is that I think he is such a superb writer, whatever he's writing about. But in this book, which sort of falls under your supernatural and all, I think this is really a coming-of-age story. Just happens to have snakes.
Yes. Yep. I had a... There are some supernatural elements, but it is a coming-of-age story. It's set in 1999 in my hometown, which was Bloomington, Indiana. And the big influences for me with this one, I was thinking of, you know, obviously King with The Body, but one of my favorite books is Robert McCammon's Boy's Life. I don't know if you remember that one.
I have read it, yep.
Love that. And John Irving, A Prayer for Owen Meany. So I wanted to do that coming of age thing with the narrator having that reflective voice where they sort of are looking back across the years too.
So Michael started his writing career at a ridiculous age, when he was barely out of high school. And so there's an autobiographical element in the book, not only about what it's like to be young, but also what it's like to have your first job as a private investigator, which is what you did. I think it's great that you can access all those memories because you're not, you know, 19 anymore.
No, I'm certainly not. But the memories are still there. Yeah, I mean, the dream job of anyone in high school is working for a private detective, and I was determined to do that. I mean, why? What else would you want to do with your time?
Come on, Michael. I wanted more explanation.
It's the dream. I mean, I knew I wanted to write, but the idea that anyone was making a living in my town, too. It wasn't a very large town. You know, population's about 100,000. Quintessential college town.
Right.
So there were three PIs in the Yellow Pages. This is back in the era of the Yellow Pages. And I was working with sort of the counselor who was in charge of that program for my high school, which was called Independent Study.
Okay.
And I said I wanted an independent study in the art of private investigation. And she said, great, if you can find a qualified mentor to do this. And I don't think she believed I was going to come up with that person. But I ended up just through sheer dumb luck finding an incredibly qualified mentor whose name was Don Johnson, which is, I mean, all-time great PI name.
It is,
but
really.
At that point, he had just been named National PI of the Year, which is a real thing. And he was very interested in the profession in terms of like continuing education, and there are different certifications. So certified legal investigator, certified fraud examiner, mm-hmm. all of these different things. So he was actually someone who was willing to go out of his way to, you know, put some time in and teach me the business. And it was it was so much fun. I'm at that age, you know, when you're 16, you feel as if you're a fully formed adult human. And you chafe kind of at the idea of anyone who thinks otherwise. Tends to be your parents and everyone, you know, in the school. So to have this person, this professional, in this very unique world, who regarded me as, I mean, not an equal, but he didn't have kids. I don't think he really knew how to talk to kids. So he just talked to me like an adult. And I loved that. I loved everything about the weird training assignments he would give me.
Like what?
I mean, some of them actually, in retrospect, probably weren't that great because it was sort of like sanctioned stalking. Like he would, my surveillance training, he's like, go, you know, go to the mall, follow someone. Then like when they get into their car, or, you know, record all of the details of what they did, where they went, get the license plate, all of that. But I'm following strangers. And in retrospect, that probably could have led to some trouble, but it was an enormous amount of fun. More of it was spent in the, what should have been boring, the, you know, dusty old records of the county clerk's office and the auditor and the treasurer. But I learned how you build a paper trail through, you know, tax bills and property records and divorces and traffic tickets and all of that. This, as mundane as it sounds, when you're 16, 17 years old, it was so much more fun and interesting than school. I mean, I had a very low level of interest in class.
Okay.
Outside of class, I was pretty engaged. And this was the, you know, absolute peak to me because I'm going home and I'm reading at that point. I had read Hammett and Chandler, but I was starting to get into Lehane and Connolly and Crace. So I'm reading about the PI world. I know that I want to do it. And that I want to write those books, but now I'm sort of living it a little bit.
You're
too.
You're living it. I know. I love that. Wow. And that was when PIs actually were gumshoes. I mean, they actually did footwork and dove into records. Today, private eyes are almost all sitting on computers, and you know, it's lost a lot of the gumshoe element.
I don't know. You're right, of course, to an extent. Although I would argue, there still is, surveillance is still a need. And so you actually have to learn that art of how to hide in someone's rearview mirror. And
right.
I think that still matters. And field interviewing is still very important.
Well, that's encouraging because I was thinking the private eye profession is largely dying, you know, for lack of interest, but apparently not, huh?
No, and it was a great exercise as a writer because you're looking at all of the weird details of things, and some of what he was giving me at, you know, a very young age is, you know, these sort of training tips I will do now just to pass the time, but then they give you a great eye for detail with books. So perfect example, I came in last night and I went to the Hotel Valley Ho and I had dinner and I'm sitting at the bar and I can tell you they have great mirrors at that bar, by
the
way, so yeah. you can see all the doors, it's wonderful. I can tell you that there was a couple to my right. There was one woman between two guys. She was married to the guy on her right, but she was talking more to the guy on the left, which I found intriguing. There were two very drunk guys to the left who had had a really bad day making their bets on NCAA basketball. And I can tell you that the bottles are 12 in a line, and there are two glass shelves of them. It's like, well, why am I doing all of this? It's because I sort of trained my brain back then to notice all of these random details so I could pass the tests that Don would give me.
So if you write a book set in Arizona here in Scottsdale, which you might do, then you're all set, actually.
You're enhancing recall and that eye for sensory detail.
Right.
And then the thing that doesn't quite fit maybe draws your eye a little bit more. And so that's how, when you get to the question of story, it's, okay, where do you find drama? You usually find drama in conflict or contrast.
Okay.
And I think the very early days of that PI education that I'm trying to recapture in Lost Man's Lane were about building that sense of observation.
And in fact, Michael's first, was it five books, were private eye novels,
mm-hmm.
which I loved. I think you were, what, 21 when the first one published?
Yeah, I sold it when I was 20, like, and it came out, yeah, when I was 21.
Right,
yeah.
I know, it's amazing, isn't it? That you would have that great a skill set that young. Because I think the thing is that a lot of people who try to write a book at that age overwrite it. You know, they're trying to be like Hemingway or something, and you know, there are a lot of bad books that come out, but you know, you dove right in there.
You
to
didn't
write
see
a
my
good
first three,
Private
though.
Eye.
I think three unpublished books are probably certainly not suffering from being underwritten. It was, you know, swinging for the fences there. But Tonight I Say Goodbye, my first book, was actually a sequel. And I think in the first book, the first of the Lincoln Perry books, I met the character then and the supporting cast, but the story just wasn't great. And that one got pretty close to publication, too. St. Martin's took that all the way up the ladder. And I there was a week or two where it seemed as if they were going to publish it. Then they rejected it. And when my editor, Pete Wolverton, called to explain, you know, that they were regretfully going to pass, I was so young and naive that I told him it was no problem because I was already like well along on the sequel, which shows not great business sense. When someone says we're not going to publish the first book, you don't reassure them by saying, don't worry, the sequel is well in hand. But the sequel ended up being the second book, and it you know, really did work out.
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, I think it's a wonderful story, and there's so few people that I think have successful careers starting at the age that you did. I'm sure we could find some. Who can we think of?
I mean, Fitzgerald.
Okay.
So.
Well, there's an icon.
There's a good one, Mary Shelley. There aren't a lot of us, though, I will say.
Not a lot. So here we are with a mature Michael Caruta writing as Scott Carson, but accessing who he was as a teen. And, you know, I was a teenager in the 1950s, but I was interested reading it that what you describe as life in Bloomington, Indiana in the 1990s wasn't actually that different from life in the 1950s. But if we tried to do it today to be a teenager, it would be, I think, a different world.
You're absolutely right. One of the reasons I loved the year 99 was, beyond the fact that I lived it, I think it feels like this time capsule where we were right on the edge of a very different world, because I grew up with technology. I grew up with computers, my beloved AOL Instant Messenger, which I think was the pinnacle achievement of social media. It's only gotten worse since then. But we didn't have the omnipresent technology following us out the door. And, you know, our lives weren't always recorded in that way.
We didn't have a phone to carry.
We didn't have, exactly.
You know, now, you know, you feel, you panic if you leave home now without a phone, and all these things occur to you. What if I'm in an accident? What if somebody needs to call one of my kids? You know, and it used to be that you just left home and, you know, you deal with it when you got back. But
it was a superior way to be a kid, I think,
too. It really was.
Because you could get away with some stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know,
I
remember riding my bicycle all around, you know, Chicago. Well, not Chicago, but the suburbs, and out into places my parents probably would have had a stroke if they'd known I was out there by myself in the lagoons or something. But today they could put a GPS tracker on me, you know, and I probably couldn't get away with it.
When people say, how did you learn how to plot a complicated story? I think back to being 16, I'm like, it was probably trying to get away with shit from my dad, honestly, because he was not someone you weren't going to get away with anything winging it with him. And you certainly were not going to improve your chances with a revision, because he was one of those people who remembered the original timeline and chronology and cast of characters. So, yeah, you needed to be, and it's not like I was doing terrible things, but just to, you know, escape and get a little freedom. And the car was so huge. I'm fascinated by, and maybe it's not, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, it's just so different. My friends who have teenage kids, who turn 16, 17, and they have very little interest in getting the driver's license. That was everything.
Yep.
It was.
We had driver's ed in high school. In fact, you had to take it in order to graduate. And, you know, I remember driving. We would, you know, have classes where we drove around the parking lot at Nutrier and all. And then my parents paid extra for separate, you know. I still can't parallel park, so, as we were discussing earlier. So it wasn't entirely good. But it was your passport to freedom. It was, you were off your bike and off your roller skates, and, you know, you could then do stuff.
Right. And when I talk about that desire to feel like an adult, Mm-hmm. I mean, nothing made you feel more like an adult than getting your driver's license and being able to set off into the world and have some autonomy and some freedom and just the trust of that. But it was the holy grail for, I think, every generation, probably post-war, you know, from the 50s on to early 2000s. And now it's not. I mean, there's still, I know it's.
Well, it was also before rideshare and other things. And it depended to some degree on where you lived if there was actually public transportation. My husband grew up, for example, in New York City, so he didn't need to learn to drive. Whereas I grew up in a suburb where, you know, there wasn't any.
Right, it probably felt more like Bloomington. I mean, I couldn't catch a bus from my house.
Well, it did, you know, and one of the things that I thought was so interesting about the book was the geology of Bloomington. I didn't realize that it was like earthquake belt area. And even though I think the worst earthquake this country ever had was centered in Missouri, if I remember right, it was a terrible earthquake, right? I mean, you'd think it would have been like San Francisco, right, with the San Andreas Fault. But no, there was some catastrophic earthquake in Missouri. But when part of the danger in your story, part of the supernatural danger, can you keep it caged up, is what if there's an earthquake and, you know, and it opens up the fissures again?
Yeah, I love playing with that idea of the natural world driving the supernatural, because I think there's always an unknown. We feel like we really know a lot about the world, but there's always an unknown out there. I'm thinking about this as Bloomington, actually Lost Man's Lane, will be the epicenter of the eclipse. The path of totality passes over it for like 4 minutes and 3 seconds, which I think is, if it's not the longest stretch in the country, it's very close. And it's just a huge story in Bloomington. They've got 300,000 people coming in, which is 3 times the population of the town. And I was thinking about how because we can predict it, because we know that it is coming, it's exciting. Right. But if you did not know, and we don't have to go that many generations back, that many eras back, imagine how terrifying that is when day literally turns to night. And every culture has their eclipse stories, and almost all of them are scary. They viewed it as a warning or a punishment.
And the people who could sort of, you know, be astronomers had an edge, because in some of them were able to, you know, predict it would happen. Isn't it? I think the Battle of Hastings in 1066, in part, wasn't there an eclipse that was part of the reason that the Norman forces won?
And the unification of some American Indian tribes under Tecumseh basically boils down to a bunch of previously warring tribes believing that he had some sort of supernatural power because he had, quote, predicted,
right,
you know, this event. So I love the idea of working in that history of the natural landscape and then trying to just tweak that a little bit and make it as creepy as possible.
Well, it certainly leaves us with an ominous ending, you know, because I'm not going to spoil the ending, but the menace is not forever controlled.
No, and we've been having this conversation for 20 years as I keep writing standalones, by and large. And, you know, the debate of, you know, should you be doing a series, should you be doing standalones? This is one that Stephen King, who graciously read a very early version, and actually saved a character's life, which I wish I could discuss without spoiling it, but there's just no way. He mentioned in an email, he said, you know, you could do a sequel on this one. And I felt like he was kind of like knocking on my head, like, hey, dummy, like there's a chance to build the brand here. We'll see.
Before I forget, Richard Chismar is actually supposed to be coming here live in October, which is so wonderful.
For memorials?
Whatever his October book is. Yeah.
I haven't read it. I have a galley. Right.
Michael is very much a friend of Richard Chismar, who's also part of Stephen King's group and so forth. So, and Michael spends half his year in Maine and half his year in Indiana. So when you're in Maine, there you are.
And I wrote most of the Bloomington book in Maine, which I think helped a lot. I had never written about my hometown. And I think that's because it's small enough that everyone, no matter how many times you say, I'm not basing a character on a real person, everyone smiles and nods, and then they busy themselves trying to guess who the real person is. Like, they do not believe that. So I kind of kept my fiction away from the small town. And I think it's funny that when I finally wrote about home, I wrote the book from 1,200 miles away and under a
different name.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I found my way home.
But now we have your last summer's book, An Honest Man, and that actually is set in Maine, although offshore, on an island. So did you write this book in Bloomington?
That one traveled. That one put up enough of a fight that I had to write it in both places. And we went through a lot of drafts there. That was my pandemic book.
I see. I love this book. It's a wonderful, and I don't believe a sequel is possible. No. Even though your first five books were, in fact, the same character, I think you exhausted for yourself anyway the possibilities of sequels for a while. Or not sequels, but a series, I should say.
Yeah, it might be something I come back to later, but I love standalones. I love creating the new world, new characters. And then I'm beginning to get more into the screenwriting side of things, too.
Right.
Which, you know, each standalone you can sell and set up as another project, whether I'm writing on it or just selling it. You get one shot at that with a series character, and then it can be tied up, you know, for years. I mean, Michael Connelly now has a lot of success with Bosch, but for a long time there, those rights were tied up and he couldn't do anything with them. And there are plenty of other examples. So from the screenwriting standpoint, it's also useful because you can introduce another project to that world every year, basically every 18 months.
But are you looking primarily at movies then? You're not looking at long-form television?
No, so I'm an honest man. I'm working on, I'm two scripts into it right now. I'm working with the team that made Mare of Easttown, if anyone watched that.
Okay.
I loved it.
So it'd be like one season, but six or eight episodes?
No, it's like actually, it would be ongoing. So it was kind of funny. You said there's no way to do a sequel. You're right with the book.
But wrong with the screenwriter.
But I can. The thing I really enjoy about the adaptation is making it very different. I'm the worst person in the world to do a faithful adaptation of my book because I don't get the point. Like, I wrote it already. I did that story. So it's how can I push it in a different direction and essentially revise it? And that's what I love about it.
So why, I know we're detouring around here, but why have you gotten so deeply into screenwriting? Is it just a test of power? Is it more money, which is certainly a useful thing? You know, is it a different medium that really excites you? What is it?
I mean, a little bit of all of the above, but I've been writing novels since I was 16.
Right.
25 years of doing the same thing. I still love them. I don't intend to quit. But I think having a different medium and stretching, it's also going to make me a better novelist. I have no doubt about that. But creatively to stretch and try something different is...
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Who was I talking to the other day? I can hardly ever remember who I'm talking to because every day it's so many people. But whoever it was said that their original draft of their book was all dialogue. 100% dialogue. And then they had to go back and actually fill in all around the dialogue. So basically it's a screenplay, right? And then instead of like the set and the actors and so forth doing all that, the author then has to go back and fill it all in. I was fascinated.
I've heard a lot of different process approaches.
It's a very successful writer too. I just can't remember which one because I've done
so
many.
It would scare the hell out of me.
Well, but I mean, I thought it was a really interesting point because my understanding for many novelists is the hard part about writing a screenplay is to reduce the book just to dialogue because basically a screenplay is almost entirely dialogue with directions. You know, I know Diana had a really hard time with the first season with Outlander, you know, she wasn't writing it, but she was watching it. And the other thing was that a scene that in a book you can block out to work X in the location, maybe the room or whatever it is doesn't allow it. And, you know, so therefore they have to change it regardless of what you wrote.
I guess I wouldn't go quite that far in the importance of dialogue. I think one of the things I've learned in that process is, I mean, you're not overwriting, you're not being novelistic in descriptions. That's why they have set design. But I think the best screenplays are moving the beats and trusting the actors. It's action and it's less talking. You know, it really, I think you're going to identify an amateur screenplay pretty quick by how many monologues are in there, how long are characters talking. A clinic in this is looking at a Coen Brothers script. You'll see pages of one sentence, one sentence, one sentence, but it's moving, it's moving, it's moving. They're not over-describing the shot, but they're also not sitting with characters who are talking in a room. You know, that usually kills it.
So am I thinking of the opening scene of the first Daniel Craig James Bond? Anybody remember that? It was the best action scene. It went on forever. And finally, when it came to a halt and you thought it was done, it wasn't done. Remember, there was like a second bang, but there was no dialogue
at all
while this was going. And yep. It must have been at least 5 minutes. I mean, it just went on forever.
I think about No Country for Old Men, which I thought was a great script.
Okay.
And how long that moves in silence. And the tension that is built by Javier Bardem's Chigurh character, you know, sort of squaring off against Brolin when they're in those two hotel rooms and they both know that one's on the other side. But, I mean, there's no dialogue. It's all the beats of choice and decision within that tense silence that really makes it work.
Or not, and not you, the screenwriter?
Well, it has to be both. It's on the page.
Yeah.
It's
okay.
It's in the novel, too.
Right. Well, let's go back to Lost Man's Lane and actually talk about it since we've been all over the place. We're in Bloomington, Indiana. You've all figured that out, right? Okay. And what's the name of our young man who is our...
Marshall Miller is our protagonist, yeah. So he has a single mother. He has absolutely no idea of his father's identity. And she has refused to give him any clue. So that once he finds his way into the private detective's orbit, he sort of has a dream of using these new skills to trace the identity of his father. And the book opens with Marshall is on his first drive. He's just gotten his license. That's that moment we were talking about.
Right.
And he's promptly pulled over by police. And while he's with this officer who's suddenly takes like a pivot and becomes almost sociopathic in his anger, Marshall looks in the rearview mirror and he sees there's a girl in the back seat of the police car and she's crying. And the next time he sees her face, it's on a missing poster. And he realizes he was the last person who has seen this missing girl. So that's our launch point.
Other than the policeman whose car she was in. Right. So I'm trying to think how we can do this. I hate to give away what the actual menace is. So
yeah, please don't.
I know. I'm trying to figure out, you know, how there's this really...
We set the hook and trust the reader.
We did. There's this whole scary thing, but if we talk about it, it won't be so scary. But I guess my question is if you're looking for... Because, I mean, I've read your other books where there are other menaces and, you know, sometimes in water, sometimes underground, sometimes in a hotel. You know, you've had a great time doing all that. How do you pick the menace?
It's a really good question, and I don't have an answer. I feel like it sort of picks me. The thing that just feels spooky to me on any level, you know, there are snakes in this book, for example, and I think snakes are... primally, we are wired to fear them, right? And then there's all this mythology and symbolism of the snake. But I was well into the draft before the first snake appeared. And then I went back and layered in that thread throughout. But I think I was, 250 pages into the book. And someone in the Hoosier National Forest, which is near Bloomington, I was in Maine when this happened. Someone posted a video of they were hiking and found two rattlesnakes fighting. And I mean, they come up off the ground and smash together and twist around each other. And I had never seen anything like that before. And I was thoroughly creeped out. But then because I have a warped mind, it just sort of stuck. And I was turning that over. And I thought I could really do something with that. You know,
if you'd read the Arizona Republic today, you would have seen they had a whole section about what to do if there's a rattlesnake in your car. And Brittany Griner made the Republic not.
Is wet your pants an option? Is that
no? It's okay. Close the door and call the pros. But I thought it was interesting. Did you see that Brittany Griner found a rattlesnake in her house and she actually went after it and contained. And they said no, that's the wrong thing to do. And also, do not run because that will scare the snake. What you want to do is just cautiously retreat. And then don't try to deal with it yourself. You know, call the professionals. And
don't shoot video for Michael. No, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my daughter, who lives up north in North Scottsdale, they've had a kind of ongoing rattlesnake problem. And at one point, there were two of them that lived in their pool. The pool clean, whatever it is by the pool where the pool cleaner dumps in the home. And they just could not get rid of the snakes. But eventually somebody captured them and sent her a video. They took one of the snakes out into the desert and let it go. And it went down a gopher or prairie dog hole so fast, you know. I mean, it was just like, it was gone. And you thought about these poor little guys underground and here comes this, you know. I felt terrible but they try to take them out in the desert and let them go rather than kill them. That's my point. Yeah.
I've encountered one in the wild, and I was hiking in Virginia, and I was so amazed by. So it rattled before I saw it, and you know immediately. You would think that there would be some level of hesitation because I didn't even know I was in snake country, and you would think there'd be a moment of like. Could that be a rattlesnake? That can't be a rattlesnake, but there is like absolute certainty. And I thought that was an interesting indicator of how hardwired it is, you know, into us to pay attention to that sound.
That's very true. But then, you know, I have been remembering that at one point we were traveling. I can't remember where we were. And my husband came within that of stepping on a coral snake. And, you know, coral snakes are really deadly, but they're also really tiny. And they don't give any warning. No. So, you know.
I'd rather encounter the rattlesnake,
exactly,
for sure.
Exactly. At least you have some kind of a shot. But I think most humans are wired against are wired to fear snakes for whatever reason.
When I worked with the Big Cat Rescue Sanctuary, so it's a crazy place that takes in abused lions and tigers and cougars. And it's amazing work. But one of the things that was kind of intriguing to me about these apex predators, the lions and tigers, they're afraid of snakes. And the keepers would notice, be like, oh, Tango is staying in the back of his enclosure today. That's not like him. You know, is he sick? Is there something wrong? And it would be a harmless black snake. But they move back. They definitely steer clear.
Well, think about Kipling and, you know, Rikki Tikki Tavi.
Right.
You know, do you all know that story? About the little mongoose who, you know, takes on the cobra and saves whoever it is. And, you know, that's one of Kipling's best stories. And that was, you know, I'm sure that... people in India were constantly, I mean, cobras were their thing, not rattlesnakes. That's probably, I understand.
I take the rattlesnake over the cobra,
yeah,
too.
I mean, you know.
The more we talk about this, the more fond I'm becoming of rattlesnakes, which was unanticipated.
But. Give you a fighting chance, whatever it all is. So anyway, so here we have him. Here he is in Bloomington being mentored by a private investigator, hoping to figure out who his dad might be. Snakes are slithering around. What else happens?
I'm curious for your take on this. I would also say that it's my funniest book, and that was a goal. An Honest Man is a very, I'm proud of it. You know,
yeah.
it was nominated for the Edgar. That meant a lot to me. But it's a very grim world. And coming out of that and coming out of the pandemic and just our political moment, I really wanted to have fun and do something a little bit lighter, which is one of the reasons I ended up back in 99. It just seemed like a lighter time in some ways, although in many ways it was not. And I mentioned John Irving before, and I mentioned Robert McCammon. I love those kind of set piece approaches where you can push into the humor of awkwardness, which I think I was going to say we all go through in high school, but I mean, I still go through it on a daily basis. But there, it's so easy to mine for really good, excruciating laughs. And I tried to build some longer set piece scenes that accomplished that. And I would say I had more fun writing this than I've had writing anything in a long time, just because of that. Some of the characters I thought would float on. Sean Weller is one. That was supposed to be a placeholder name, and we would never meet him. And then he kind of takes, he doesn't take over the book, but he becomes a major character in the book. And the story had to be reshaped because of him. At times he was a little bit annoying because I just had to deal with him so much. But that was one of those, you know, I'm 20 books into this, and you ask, well, you know, why do I keep coming back to the novel as opposed to just do scripts for a while? Yeah. It's moments like that when you're discovering a new character and you feel like they are guiding the story, and they're talking and you're just transcribing. You're not telling them what to do. You're just catching up.
I think any of us who can remember what it was like to be a teenager. Here's the thing. When you're a teenager, particularly, young kids don't really seem to do that. You're convinced that every eye is on you all the time.
All the time.
If you, you know, I can remember standing up on the tee, for example, at, you know, at the country club to play, and I thought, everyone's going to watch me hit this ball. You know, you just know that that's the case. And part of growing older and maturing is you recognize that nobody actually cares if you're on the tee about to hit the ball. And so you sort of distance yourself.
We're all sharing this world of narcissism where we just assume, well, everyone's looking at
that's
us.
Right. Yes. But I think that's a normal part of adolescence when we're, you know, trying to figure out who we are and, you know, our place and all. So I thought the humor in your book came from, you know, those awkward moments of adolescence where, and I could relate to that. But I have also been recommending this book to young adults because I think if you actually are one and you're reading this, that there's a lot, you know, to connect with.
I did it right.
I don't really understand the young adult market much. I mean, we don't deal a huge amount with it. Or I don't, although we sell a lot of it. But, you know, I don't. But this is a book I thought, okay, you know, you could really read this book from, you know, like 14 on up.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, that's the magic of some of Stephen King's books to me. I think of It. And, you know, that speaks to the 14-year-old reader, but then it speaks to the 60-year-old reader, too.
I'm not sure that Stephen's ever really progressed beyond being 14. I mean,
he's a secret genius.
I mean that in a really nice way, but I think the fact that he can constantly access what it was like to be like that is one reason that he is such a creative and, you know, prolific
Absolutely.
Novelist. You know, and obviously I think that applies to you, too. So, anyway, the arc of the story here, we won't say how it comes out, is this young man working to find his father and what might come in his way. And, you know, that's kind of the quest, because a narrative really needs to be a quest, doesn't it?
Yeah, he has two quests. You know, we have
the
external quest of plot is trying to explain what happened to Meredith Sullivan. And then after she...
the girl that was in the back of
the girl he saw, yes. So, you know, that's the plot-driven quest. And then there's the more interior and internal to the character quest of identity. And I love a good identity story. I think we all connect with those on some level. So trying to weave those two narratives together was the goal. And it was the most... the fun points came when those two stories collide.
Well, do we have any questions that any of you would like to ask? Yes.
I do. I'm actually a private investigator too, so I wanted to kind of hear, when did you transition from doing that to focusing more on your writing?
Can you repeat? Yeah, so we have a fellow PI in the audience. It was my part-time job all the way through college, and then it was my day job. I was writing at that point, but it was my day job for probably 4 years after that, 5 years after that. And I never really got out of it. So we still, we own like, own a detective agency, but my wife, that is her business. I have very little to do with it now. And she's more focused on the background check. So it's much more the corporate side, the element that's doing field investigation and surveillance, things like that, sort of split off. But I met my wife. She had the MFA in creative writing. I had no training in creative writing, but I was a criminal justice major and had a PI license. And now she owns a detective agency and is a licensed PI, and I have nothing to do with that. So it was an interesting, bait and switch, I guess. But I stayed. I would also come back occasionally when my old boss was still, when he was more active in it, he would bring me back now and then to help out with the case. So I'm curious, now knowing that you're a PI, would you agree with me that the influence of the computer is a little overhyped?
Yeah, and I think that people also don't realize that there is still active PIs, because you're not really aware that like surveillance work, you are essentially like stalking someone, so it feels out of body, it feels abnormal.
Absolutely.
Whether it's for like a workman's comp or like insurance things, or even like cheating scandals are really big, especially in Scottsdale. Those cases are
yes.
Actually like very alive.
Aha, uh-huh. Cheating scandals in Scottsdale.
I never did infidelity work. And the reason was my boss used to, and then he took a case where he was supposed to be investigating, I think on behalf of, is the male, yeah, okay, so the client was the guy, and he thought his wife was cheating, hires my boss. Before my boss has an opportunity to really do any work at all on this, the wife sent photographs, hard copy photographs, to the client to sort of up the scale in their personal feud of her with the other guy, and the client murdered the wife and the boyfriend. And my boss then spent, I don't know how much time, embroiled in this court case. I think he got a retainer, but it was like, this was a nightmare. Yeah, exactly. Way more than, so he always tried to stay away from that. But with that, Indiana's a no-fault divorce state, so custody cases were huge. And that's a lot of overlap on the same terrain. You know, it's like, it's not a cheating case necessarily, but it always is. Or very frequently is. And those were, I don't know what your experience was, but from an emotional perspective, it's always so draining when you are dealing with, you're seeing the kids. I mean, you're seeing, you know, from a distance, you're usually not talking to the kids, that the attorneys are handling that. But I don't know. There were a few cases that just stick with me where I felt like I was watching kids who had almost no chance. They were just going to be collateral damage in this feud between.
And that's kind of reality. I also am a legal assistant, so I work in divorce and child custody. Yep. So I see both sides, because there's two separate jobs that I have. I do the investigating on the side before I'm going to transition and be full-time investigator. So it's kind of like I'll see both worlds, like the reality of like going through divorce and child custody issues. And then when there are the cheating cases, you know, it's sometimes inevitable, and that person might not want to see what you're going to find, but...
The other... So I'm curious, because you're active in it. I was sort of closing out my time there, one of the things that struck me was people were getting much savvier about their technological footprint. So they were worried about, okay, I'm going to clean up my social media. I'm going to lock my phone down. I understand that there are tracking apps, all of those things, but they are not thinking about the actual human who would follow them. So in a way, I think surveillance still is an extremely that's what I would have guessed. Okay. Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, like you would never
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you understand what I meant with the phrase hide in the rearview mirror. It's even stuff like that. It's like, okay, how long, you know, if you don't know where someone's going, it's okay, how long can you stay directly behind them? Not that long. It actually helps if you have the distracted driver, so you try to float in the blind spot, but you don't want to get hung out in a turn-only lane. And I was in the early days, I didn't have a navigation app. The first car I got that had that, I was like, oh my goodness, this is a tool, because now I can see what's coming up ahead and sort of game plan it a little bit.
And then it's stressful, like if you lose them, you have to think ahead, like where could they be going? Mm-hmm. Could they be going here? Because like, yeah, if you're at a light and like people aren't thinking they're being watched, and how often do you really look in your rear view mirror? But because we're like,
I do all the time.
But you want to have like a bumper car in between, but it's still like,
what? Yeah, you need to plan the intersections.
Yeah, like they're like, why is this car like keep getting closer than farther? Like, it's just really strategic, but
this is amazing. When we go off camera, don't leave. And you either, because we're getting close, Christina, to the breaking story. I know.
Can I ask my question?
Sure.
Yes. Yeah.
So what was your playlist for Lost Men's Lane?
Okay, so it's actually documented at the beginning of each chapter. It was a lot of 90s hip hop. That was pretty much the driver to put me back in that era. So,
you know, isn't it? I read somewhere, and I think it's true, because I can still remember the music when I was like, the music that we learned when we're teenagers is the music we hear the whole rest of our lives. It is the music of our life.
Oh, it really calls you back.
Yeah, but you don't forget it. You know, I can still do Chubby Checkers on Blueberry Hill, for example. I mean, yeah, it's been like, you know, I'm 83, and how long ago has it been since, you know, since I heard all that? Probably in like 1952 or something, but it's still alive in my head. Elvis Presley, you know, the Beatles. I mean, I was there for all of that.
So I played a lot of, there was some good music in the mix. There was some terrible music in the mix, but I wanted anything that would anchor me in that, you know, in that time.
And do you include both the good and the bad in there?
Yeah, I enjoy having some characters who fight over the quality of the music, too. So there's a character named Carrie, who's Marshall's friend, but kind of his, his secret crush. And she has good taste in music. She thinks he has terrible taste in music. So I enjoyed the
dramatic routine.
Well, it was everything. I mean, you know, making mix CDs. It was a lot of angst. You had to get that right.
So Christina is actually debuting her debut novel that won the Tony Hillerman Prize right here on Monday afternoon.
Congratulations.
Or Monday
that
evening,
is
rather.
Amazing.
So very exciting for her. But she's also an NPR reporter. So I do have something to talk to you all about. Are there any other questions that you got? Anybody? Nope. In that case, Jacob, you can turn us off. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.